Assuming I don't need any introduction, but if I do, then that's me. And try and provoke some discussion on thermal core mantle interaction, which we haven't heard very much about yet. And since I'm saving my powder for next week, I will avoid the exciting stuff and leave it for that. Won't give anything away, just give some hints. Anyway, for those that don't know, the core mantle system, both the core and the mantle interact, convect, and the mantle convects a lot slower than the core by a factor of about 10 to the 5. So the mantle sees a constant lower, constant temperature on its lower boundary with variations of the order of tiny fractions of a degree. It's in a laboratory, this would be the dream way of setting up a constant temperature, rather than pumping water through a constant temperature water bath at something like 100 times as fast as the convective golden syrup or whatever you're using for the convective fluid. You've here got, you're going at 10 to the 5 times faster, and the thermal conductivity is several orders of magnitude higher as well. So it's a very constant temperature. And because this is a convecting system and you can only have one boundary condition, then it's inevitable that the mantle will have variable heat flux across it, and that's what the core sees. And as Dave Stevenson's very fond of saying, the mantle is the master and the core is the slave. The core just responds to what the mantle tells it to do. So it's inevitable that the mantle is going to have, that the mantle has an effect on the core dynamo. And the only questions that remain, I've got three questions, but it remains to see how big these lateral variations in heat flux are, and I'll show that they're actually huge. And being huge might not be good enough. Being huge still might not do very much, so how big do they actually have to be to influence the dynamo? And that's a much more difficult question. So the answer to that is it depends. And lastly, is there any observational evidence, which there is? Well, I'll do them actually in that order, because that's the sensible thing to do. There's two ways of estimating how big this heat flux is. The first one is to use seismic tomography and assume that the shear wave velocity is, or the seismic velocity is varying because of variations in temperature. And these temperature variations, if you assume that, are up to 1,000 degrees. Maybe 500 would be a more reasonable figure in the boundary, in the bottom 200 kilometers or so of the mantle. And so if you think of that as a thermal boundary layer with a constant temperature on the bottom, you can and you have a guess at what the thermal conductivity of perovskite or post-perovskite is that makes up the bottom of the mantle, then you can estimate a heat flux variation from place to place. So you need to take this temperature difference, divide it by the thickness, and multiply by the thermal conductivity. And you get an answer that's about the same as the heat conducted down the adiabat, roughly, to within an order of magnitude, which suggests that the variations are of order 100% of the heat, the average heat coming out.
Talking about the adiabat in the core.
Right? Adiabat in the core, yes.
How are you getting this 1,000 kelvins?
From you? What would you like it to be?
We produce velocity.
I look at probably Don Anderson's book. I can't think of any sort of less reputable reference. But just I mean, 500 degrees is, I thought, the variation, what people talk about. It's big, anyway. It's a lot bigger than the variations you think of in the core, which are of the order of a thousandth of a degree. And don't ask me where I get that number from. I need the blackboard. And the other way of doing it is actually just to do the mantle convection calculations. And these are like dynamo calculations. They are maybe arguably a little bit better at estimating this sort of thing. But again, it's quite reasonable to have 100% variation in heat flux across the core mantle boundary from that. So that's what we should live with, and that's what I call huge. But we shouldn't forget that these are estimates of the total heat flux coming across the core mantle boundary. And half that is just stuff conducted down the adiabat. Again, half being, everybody knows here what half is. So we then essentially have to multiply this 100% by 2 in order to get an estimate of how much variation we've got in the heat that is in the heat that's relevant to the convection in the core. So by the time we've taken this, basically we're subtracting off the adiabatic heat from what I'm saying is the average heat that this is 100% of. So we're going to have, it's reasonable to look at heat flux variations of order 1 in all this. Well, how big do they have to be? Well, this is just discussion of the fluid dynamical effect, the effect on the fluid dynamics, perhaps. But I mean, it depends on the parameters, but they can be very, very large. So large, in fact, that when K.K. Zhang and I started this calculation, he used a parameter to describe this variation and called it epsilon, which is because he was out to show how big an effect you could get when epsilon was very small. And we've recently been doing calculations where epsilon has gone to infinity, where we didn't actually have any heat on average coming out at all. So it was an inappropriate letter, but there we are. Some comments. You can't drive the dynamo with these things, and the easiest way to see that is just to consider that to generate magnetic field, you actually have to counteract the entropy loss due to dissipation, and in the core, the main entropy loss is probably in the magnetic field. And to actually put to counterbalance that entropy is a gain. With heat, you have to put heat in at a higher temperature than you take it out, and we're putting it in and taking it out in the core mantle boundary, which is essentially the same temperature. So you can't drive the dynamo this way, but it can have a huge effect on the fluid dynamics. For a start, there's no critical Rayleigh number with horizontal heating. It's like convection from a radiator, where you don't have to exceed any temperature difference or anything to get it going. And it can have a very large effect. In fact, we've seen the results of it was Nathan's experiments, wasn't it, last week, where he had this big convective roll that always went round the same way, and that looked awfully to me like an effect of lateral variations on the experiment. So they can have a very big effect. And actually, there's a little bit of there's a sort of analogy with the Coriolis force here, because the Coriolis force has a dramatic effect on the fluid dynamics. But it does no work. And likewise, this doesn't do much for the entropy, but it can have a big effect. So what we've found, and mostly I'll just discuss the non-magnetic calculations that I've done. It depends on the following. It helps if you have a length scale of the boundary condition that's similar to a length scale that the convection wants to drive anyway. Then the boundaries have a bigger effect. Inertia seems to destroy or inhibits boundary effects. Obviously, if you drive the thing like crazy, it's a high Rayleigh number. However big the boundary is, it is liable not to see the boundary condition, particularly if you do it at the top. So the other thing we found is that if you have what you need at the top is enough thermal diffusion for the boundaries condition to actually have an effect deeper down in the core. And it would be nice to have a nice big thermal diffusivity, but we're not allowed to do that. And so, do I mean big? Good conductivity, small diffusivity, but we're not really allowed to do that. But we could just lower the Peclet number by reducing the flow, which I'll talk a little bit about. So briefly, some observations. Apologies to those of you who know all this already, why we think this, that if you look at the magnetic field averaged over the historical period, then its dipole structure is sort of concentrated just outside the tangent cylinder. We know that and we understand why, but it's also, its longitude seems to be rather nicely correlated with the high seismic velocity around the Pacific. And it's actually rather more spectacular if you average that previous picture in latitude and just plot the thing as a function of longitude and look at the seismic velocity anomalies in there, which peak out. I just cut the bottom off, and the magnetic field, vertical component of magnetic field squared, BR squared, which is this one, and it has two peaks in roughly this longitude, which is about Siberia. Oops, I don't know why that happened. And Canada. And just as a taster for next week, notice this is much bigger than this. And I think there's further evidence in the diagram.
Because I didn't quite understand what was at the top, what it is.
The magnetic field, vertical component of magnetic field at the core mantle boundary squared.
I see.
You square it, it makes the colours nicer. It saves messing about with the graphics. And the sign is largely irrelevant to the argument, the sign of the magnetic field. Okay, so I've just noticed this difference here. And you do actually see it in the dynamo models as well. It's nice. I don't know. I've obviously got some timer set. Looking around to see if it's Kathy Johnson. Good. I'll explain why. If you just take all the paleomagnetic data from the last 5 million years, which goes through quite a few reversals, change the sign of the reversal because the dynamo doesn't care what the sign is, and just do the standard sort of thing that you do for modern data, you get a rather smooth map, but it has two blobs in the same place in the northern hemisphere that the modern field has, and there's a sort of hint of something down here as well. And we did this a long time ago, and there's been a big NSF program to improve the data, and which Kathy Johnson either runs, or she's the one usually reporting on it at AGU Progress, and my assessment of the whole program is that they've actually managed to make this map look rather worse since then, so I'll be honest about that. This is actually a very difficult thing to do, because the whole problem with paleomagnetic data is systematic errors, and you're asking an awful lot, because you're looking at sort of angles of 2 degrees, which is approximately the error you make in a paleomagnetic measurement. That's about the consistency you can get, so it's difficult. Another piece of evidence is that the time variations of the magnetic field is very different in the Pacific than it is in the other hemisphere, if you like, if you call the Pacific that big. And this is an illustration of it, that in historical times, this is what's happened in Hawaii to the declination. It's been between 5 and 10 degrees, or between about, it's varied by 5 degrees in the last few hundred years. And if you go to the, choose another longitude, which I chose 0 for Greenwich Meridian, same latitude because its declination is different at different latitudes, we've had this enormous change of about 20 degrees. And then if you actually look at the paleomagnetic data from Hawaii, which has been dated by carbon-14, this, by the way, I mean, I know it looks like a cloud of points, but the scale is different, right? We are looking at an error here of plus minus 5 degrees or thereabouts, and that's me drawing a line through it without any scientific sort of, I didn't mess about with statistics or anything. But that plot on here, stuck in here, is that in the Atlantic, this time we've got here, it's gone down to there and come back up. So that's the scale of the thing we're looking at. And I think the really nice thing about this Hawaiian study is because normally you don't have these dates, so normally you've just got a scatter to play with. And what this is telling us is that it's quite possible that in the Pacific we're actually seeing a quite different cause of the secular variation, because it's actually happening on a much longer timescale. And if you look at the inclination, I haven't got the plot with me, but the inclination has changed a fair amount, but very smoothly over this long 1,000-year timescale instead of the 100-year timescale you see in the Atlantic. And lastly, the reversal paths. I talked a bit about this before, that the reversals seem to stick on this as well. So the whole thing can be, the general idea, which is the easy bit, is that places where the mantle's cold suck a lot of heat out of the core, and that induces downwelling, and where it's hot, it induces upwelling. And that, now, that, by the way, is not a thermal wind, right? Remember, it's rotating, and thermal winds, a thermal wind would have the flow blowing across these regions. Same reason why you look at a weather map and you see the winds going round, going parallel to the isobars. That's the Coriolis force making them go at right angles to what would otherwise be sensible. To get this, you actually have to have a cooperation between the underlying convection and the boundary condition. And then the next stage is to say, well, magnetic field lines that happen to be poking through the core mantle boundary run on a conveyor belt and get concentrated by the downwellings. So we have we want downwelling concentrating magnetic field around the Pacific, where the seismic velocity is fast and presumably the mantle is cold because it's of all that subduction that's been going on for the last 100 million years. And quite possibly, we haven't really explored this properly yet, but quite possibly the regions where the seismic velocity is low might not necessarily have to be hot for these calculations, because we might just be looking, dynamo might just be sensitive to where it's cold. Okay, non-magnetic convection. This is a relatively straightforward calculation to do. You can use high Ekman number. There's no need to do anything complicated, really. The things one notes is, yes, there's a resonance when you've got similarity between the wave number you've applied on the boundary and the wave number of the convection for a homogeneous boundary condition. And you even get secondary resonance. In other words, if the underlying convection has four roles and you put on an m equals 2 boundary condition where m is the azimuthal wave number, then you get a boost to the kinetic energy there as well. The simplest thing you get when you start applying a boundary condition like this is that these rolls, which would normally drift around at a nice steady rate in the simple low supercritical Rayleigh number case, goes unsteady because the configuration likes to be in a situation where it's bringing heat up to where it's needed, and doesn't like to be next to a place where it's not needed, so it rushes past there and then slows up. And then if you increase the strength of this boundary condition, you can make the solution, the rolls go stationary. You get a stationary solution that's locked to the boundary condition. And this was a very interesting, it is actually a saddle node bifurcation. So when just at the point where the rolls want to start drifting, the instability actually sets in as a wave of infinite period. So I've lost my nice movie of this. This is rather old work, but it's rather nice to show the movie because you have this boring thing that just sits there for a while, and just as everyone's got fed up with looking at it, sort of flips over to the next stable, nearly stable point. And we said we did actually say and got it into the JFM that this was the first saddle node bifurcation to be seen in fluid mechanics. Still not, if anyone would like to contradict that. These things are very common in motor theory, where you've got a set of coils and an armature that gives the thing a kick. And another comment is that there's not a lot of difference whether you apply temperature or heat flux boundary conditions at low Ekman number. They have a similar effect. The question then is, are our calculations at low enough Ekman number? And that requires a certain degree of care. So when we went from temperature to heat flux boundary conditions, a lot depended. Let's look at this side. Say these are just two different velocity boundary conditions, and this is the linear onset as a function of Ekman number and Prandtl number of critical wave number, in other words, the number of rolls you get, convection rolls you get at onset. And for uniform temperature boundary conditions, it's known that this diagram is nice and simple, and that as you lower the Ekman number, it's getting lower up here, upwards, then you get progressively more and more roles, and at low Ekman number it goes like e to the minus one, m goes like e to the minus one third. Whereas here it jumps around, it goes 2, 3, 2, 1, and then suddenly jumps up to 8 or 9. And so if at these moderate Ekman numbers that are accessible for dynamo calculations, you change to a heat flux boundary condition, then you're not really very sure how many roles you have to start with, and it's not clear, that makes a huge difference to the effect of the boundary. So if you put on an m equals 2 boundary condition, then yes, you might get some effect in here and even here and here, but then suddenly you jump up to 8 roles and there's a discontinuity, and you may then suddenly see no effect. So it's that is an effect that's of
so
interest.
So your conclusion here is that 10 to the minus 4 is a low Ekman number for this purpose, right?
Yes. Once you get up there, you're okay. Yeah.
So for the Earth, though, you expect much...
Absolutely, absolutely,
much higher Rayleigh numbers, so
yep.
You would expect large wavelengths like wave number 4 or something.
For homogeneous boundary conditions, no.
No, I mean, even if you apply it, would you expect...
Ah, well, that's the issue. That's definitely... this is a technical problem with modelling the geodynamo, where I think one has to be careful. So do I want to... Let's come back to this issue of what the Earth does towards the end, because that's where I'll get evangelical about it. Okay, dynamo calculations have shown that... first, this is something we found, and I'm not sure how many people have actually published this, but this is sort of a message that everyone now agrees, whether it has any effect or not, that it's probably... biasing the literature by not reporting one's failures is a bad thing. And if you make these lateral variations too strong, then quite often you lose dynamo action. And
strong, but you mean strong relative to the Rayleigh number you
choose? Exactly. Yeah. Again, let's deal with that. These are technical matters which I think are very important because, you know, you do these calculations and we're miles away from the right parameters. And, we have one case in which 10 to the minus 4 is not terribly, may not be terribly serious, but, you know, you want to explore as much of parameter space as possible, and that, you know, that doesn't mean starting with a difficult one and going to more difficult. Boundary anomalies have no effect if convection at the top of the core is very vigorous. So that's my comment, that this is relevant to Gary's comment. In my view, most of the dynamo calculations from this point of view, because I start from the observations, and to me I am totally convinced by the observational evidence now. I've looked at both the data and the theory, and I think this effect is very real. And so I think that a lot of the calculations that have been done, which tend to show some similarity with the boundary conditions on average, but not in snapshots, are essentially being run for some reason at a Rayleigh number that's too high. So all I mean by that is that if you raise the Rayleigh number, you will destroy the effect of the boundary conditions. So... low magnetic Prandtl number is another thing, or low Roberts number is another thing that destroys the locking, and low Prandtl number, or the presence of inertia, impairs the boundary effects. Okay, so maybe Gary's been reading this last statement. But my feeling is that the geodynamo simulations, a lot of them that have been done to date, because you don't really see the modern field in many snapshots of these simulations, the implication is that we just happen to live at a time when the magnetic field looks like it's 5 million-year time average. And I think that's a coincidence that I don't like. Okay, so... next week I'll talk about the results we got We've been trying very hard to get a dynamo that really is locked up to the boundary conditions given by the seismic velocity in the lower mantle, and we have not succeeded, largely because if you crank up the lateral variations to try and lock it, you lose the dynamo before it goes completely steady. But we've got it relatively steady. You need a relatively low Rayleigh number, you need a large Prandtl number, and you need to stratify the top of the core. You need there are two ways in which one can do this. The trouble is, by the time you've chosen your Ekman number, which is inevitably too big, you choose a lowish Rayleigh number, which you have to do anyway, but your Rayleigh number is already too low. You then work through your parameters, and the only one you've got left is basically the electrical conductivity. And if you don't raise the electrical conductivity enough, you don't get a dynamo. So you're really rather stuck once you've chosen those two by choosing a Roberts number of 10, which is even, which Chris tells me is unacceptably large. Quite, you know, and I agree with him. I think we're both happy with the changing it by the first factor of 10 to the 6, but the extra factor of 10, I think, gets up everybody's nose. But you don't even have to do that if you stratify the top of the core. Okay, so the implications of all this, I'm nearly through now. I want to show you one, let me show you one movie, at least to, I can get, this is a non-magnetic calculation. I should have shown this a little earlier. It's very simple. It has the Masters and Shearer seismic velocity boundary condition. If it's homogeneous, then you would get, I think, 8 convection rolls drifting around. So it's a very simple calculation. But if you put this boundary condition on, you get a periodic solution. This solution is periodic. It just repeats away. I mean, you can see these convection rolls, but what it looks like to me is that the convection is actually completely suppressed over here. This is the Pacific. That's the African superplume for those interested. And what what appealed to me was because you seem to see these convection rolls going in here. Okay, everything's going the wrong way around. We all know that the rolls go east when you don't have a magnetic field. But it is possible to essentially stratify this region. This is a bit stratified, but because we were cunning enough to choose 8 rolls, they can actually roll their way around this African superplume without too much difficulty, but not this Pacific anomaly, which is actually much broader in longitude. And so, one period is the time between, say, forming one of these things, one of these blobs here, when it breaks off.
But you have large flow velocities right in the Pacific. So.
And we have these big shears in the Pacific, yep. So, the problem with explaining, there are a number of problems with explaining the low secular variation in the Pacific. I just think this is a really quite evocative thing because the amount of time I've spent looking at models of the secular variation, these movies of Andy Jackson's models, for example, it's very frustrating. You see this stuff drifting across in the Atlantic and it gets to the west coast of the Americas and you try and follow it in and see. And it's like waves breaking on a beach, which is really something similar to what's happening here. But I think this does address one interesting point with the Pacific. Why should the Pacific hemisphere be permanent low secular variation? When in fact, to a first approximation, the boundary condition is symmetric. It's basically a cold ring, hot in the Pacific, hot under Africa. And you would then, wouldn't be at all surprising if we were stuck in this sort of state for a longish period of time, sort of a bit like a good English summer. I mean, that sort of length of time might be the sort of fluke you could expect, or a bit longer. But why should it last 5 million years? I mean, sort of blocking highs come to mind if, from meteorology, and that can make persistent features last quite a long time. So that I always thought was far more likely that this was actually a temporary effect. But since looking at the Hawaiian data and actually seeing this, I think that quite possibly there is enough difference between the mantle structure on these around here to possibly explain this. But I don't think our dynamos are really addressing secular variation very well at all. Let me just finish for the implications and get to the evangelical bit, which is why I like it. It's a mechanism by which this locking is a mechanism by which the mantle can stamp its face on the magnetic field. That's what I really like. We've actually found a mechanism which could explain the observations. As I say, I take the observations seriously. If you start from the point of view of observations, you have to follow it. So it favours large length scales and slow time scales. And although this problem is very complicated fluid dynamically, and okay, Fritz Busser said we were crazy to start on it, potentially here, it has the potential to make the dynamo problem simpler. Because, for example, it enforces larger length scales. And I think since seeing the results I saw earlier in this meeting from the solar dynamo people, particularly Ben Brown's movies, I can see really how perhaps this might well happen when we get to more realistic parameters. This clumping of convection rolls really does seem to happen, particularly if you've got stratification. And we had a morning on scaling laws, but I didn't hear a thing about boundary conditions. And if the boundary condition says m equals 2, it changes everything that one might say about scaling laws favorably. So I think this is a problem worth serious investigation. Okay. Yeah.
Comments or questions, Steve?
Just a comment on your lock solutions. In the when you have flow over topography, they quite often get these lock solutions, and there's quite a lot known about bifurcations as you get into locking. And one of the bifurcations they see there is what they call a sniper bifurcation, which stands for something like saddle node, infinite occasion, I don't know what that stands for anyway. But I think that must be what you have.
Right.
And there are some nice dynamical systems there.
Okay, yeah. I mean, we did two things as a consequence of this. There was a sort of mathematical thing that Mike Proctor got us onto of a simple, I've forgotten what equation it was now.
Was it the
Adler?
Hmm?
No. I don't know. It was one that he. I think his paper is now out on it, but that shows the quite a lot of similar behaviour. But then there was the sort of geophysical one where we had a pendulum swinging in a water bath with a balloon on the end, so that it, as it went up, the balloon expanded and you got these two stable positions, and that did it as well, because to get from here to here is a saddle node.
I had a question, maybe to you, but maybe to the audience, I don't remember. This argument on the fact that because of the adiabatic part of the conducted, of the heat conducted on the adiabat, kind of double the heat flux variation. Is it something which has been kind of tested with actual anelastic models at all?
Don't know. I was asking you about this sort of earlier.
I think the highest resolution ones I've gotten in the last few years show that as you lower the viscosity and things get more and more turbulent, the amount of heat flux down the super adiabatic, the amount of super adiabatic heat flux relative to the adiabatic becomes much, much smaller. So you said a half, but I would say that it'll be less than a tenth of what's going down the adiabatic, which sort of makes your argument stronger in some sense. But I still have problems with a low Rayleigh number.
What do you mean by low Rayleigh number? What do we mean by a low Rayleigh number? And the Rayleigh number in the core is obviously extremely large.
Yeah. And even if it were just slightly super adiabatic, got an Ekman number of 10 to the minus 15, it's going to be true. I don't see any way you could get a super adiabatic Rayleigh number, just slightly super adiabatic. And an Ekman number is so small, it can get large wavelengths. I don't have that experience. I don't see that.
I'm not criticizing what's been done or what we're saying. I'm just saying that from what I see, almost all these parameters that are not right, when you go in the right direction, it's going to make these movies we make worse, you know. I mean, it's going to make them look less like the Earth. Everything is going to look less.
I agree. This so I think. Simpler,
I mean, at the moment, we are hoping that things are going to get simpler, in some sense, when you go towards real Earth parameters, because, you know, there just isn't enough heat around for it to be complicated.
Most of the heat comes down the 80 watt, so the amount you need to drive the dynamo becomes less and less as viscosity drops.
Yeah, I mean, but chemical convection is a bit different. I mean, that's going to be very vigorous.
I agree, it's going to be vigorous and turbulent.
Yeah. But it doesn't have to be at the top. I mean, I think we've got to stop it at the top, which I think...
This is your stratification, right?
Yeah, which I think John Hernan is going to come to the rescue. But
I mean, one of the things, back to the comment about topography, one of the things that topography is extremely good for frequently is formation of jets and flows of one sort. And so, I mean, in a sense, can we, you know, I'm trying to understand your statement of why all this can restrict the dynamo. One could argue, for example, that a shear jet would be very good for the omega part of alpha omega or so forth. How does one understand this story from that standpoint? In other words, is it that the energy is being sucked up by the zonal flow, or is it just the shearing is irrelevant, or what?
Yeah, well, I mean, what we're seeing in the models for what they're worth so far is that you get very focused downwelling and this rather broad upwelling, which doesn't actually give you much in the way of at least horizontal shear near the surface. I don't understand why this happens. It's I don't know if you've noticed it, but I mean, it's very striking, the narrowness of this, the temperature anomalies are very striking.
The strength of rotation, it's difficult to understand that.
Yeah, and these are Boussinesq calculations I'm talking about. Well, the ones I'm thinking of are not. No, the ones I'm thinking of are half and half.
So that would be the argument, isn't it?
I actually have a question about this. You seem to be looking all the time at sort of laminar flows, yeah? And I mean, you sort of mentioned at one stage that this could be happening in a sort of statistical sense. That is to say, there could be lots of small-scale turbulence. Larry finds in his models, what is going to happen at low Ekman numbers and so on. But nevertheless, this can affect the large-scale behavior, because superimposed on that was the large-scale lateral heat flux variations. So, I mean, isn't that actually a more plausible physical mechanism? I mean, of why you're actually seeing the observations that you are.
Yeah.
What you're actually seeing is a bias in the small scale turbulence rather than a large scale flow.
Maybe.
Your concentration of many small
scale. Oh, sure. Yeah. No, that's what I was saying when talking to Ben Brown about the results he was getting, where he was getting what he called nesting.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, once you've got that, then, and that's what it looks, that's certainly what some of our calculations look like, that you get 16 rolls, and it looks much more as if 8 of them go to one side and 8 to the other in forming it. So that's, I would not mix up the Earth with the calculations I'm doing. I'm just saying that the observations are there and they need to be explained. And when the observations say that something is simpler than your model, then something is wrong.
Well, probably, I'm not an expert on that, but I guess the observations are, you alluded to that, and you're happy that Casey Constable is not here, are quite quite contested how strong, say, on the time average field, how strong the evidence is on that.
I'm very happy with all of them now. I mean, I've looked at all of them. I mean, when you look at, for example, what was done on the preferred pole paths from lavas, what they actually did was they were so worried about biasing the result from choosing samples from lavas that were erupted very close together in time, that whenever they found two similar directions, they threw all but one away. And you got a random result. If you actually go carefully and actually look at where these things come from, which Jeff Love did, then these configurations come back. And if you actually look at the debate over Hawaiian secular variation, then then there hasn't actually been any secular variation in Hawaii for a long time. And
but, I mean, even though I guess a lot of the discussion about the observations is whether there are statistically significantly flux concentrations, for example, where you find them in the present geomagnetic field, or if they are not there. But I mean, usually it's also I guess the difference between what you really want with your models and has been done before by Gary and the models I've been involved is that usually we find there's a kind of statistical preference if you impose heterogeneous heat flow conditions, but often you don't see them in single snapshots. And what you, I guess, what you really want is to have it a really strong permanent feature in the model.
Well, I think that's saying something stronger than what I want. The solution we've got, which is locked, which has four blobs bang on where they are in the Earth. Right? I mean, they're and not only that, they move around at the same sort of rate as now. Now, that model is not a geophysically realistic model because it'll never reverse. So, but you know, I mean, it's a test for whether or not this effect is there. So you actually, in my view, have to accept, if you want to just have this thing coming and going, you have to accept the fact that we happen to live in a very fortunate time when the field looks like it's time average.
Okay, I think we've got to move on to another panel now.
Okay, so Dave has talked about the very long timescales, and I thought I would talk about the short sort of decadal timescales and the evidence for Cormant interactions, just because it might be of interest to those of you who don't look at the Earth. I confess this is not something that I'm really working on at the moment, but we're just about to start re-looking at it, because there's some quite interesting things going on at the moment. So the primary evidence, I think, for the interaction of the mantle and the core comes from looking at the length of day over the last 200 years or so. So that's the rotation rate of the Earth. And the rotation rate of the Earth varies on decadal timescales by about 1 part in 10 to the 8. And you can see that astronomically. And it's certainly a true effect. So these are the observations in yellow. A little bit of averaging has gone on, a little bit of time averaging has gone on. In dotted, I've just added the the gradual lengthening of the day, which is due to the interaction of the moon, so that the tidal friction of the Earth, which is a pretty long monotonic process. We know that on short timescales, if you take a small amount of data and blow it up and look at the really high resolution time series, we know that there's an interchange of angular momentum between the atmosphere and the solid Earth, and we really do understand that very well by looking at the angular momentum balance between the winds and the solid Earth. So that's very well understood. But what's left are these decadal changes in the length of day. Now, this is a very old story, so I'll go very quickly through it. But one can, of course, look at the recent secular variation of the magnetic field, and one can use various assumptions, some more dubious than others, to try to recover what the velocity field at the top of the core might be that is associated with that secular variation. So let's not go into that process. Let's assume that I can do that in a reasonable manner. So here's a typical velocity field for 1970, simply at the top of the core. Okay. Now, what is of interest I had another slide. Let's just find it. Sorry. There we go. What is of interest is that when you look at the way that the the zonal coefficients vary with time, so these are the coefficients of the flow which are axisymmetric with respect to the rotation axis. You see, so these coefficients have got definite parity with respect to the equator. So in this plot, we have T10, T30 in red are coefficients which are symmetric about the equator, whereas in blue you have these coefficients which are associated with flows which are anti-symmetric about the equator. And the remarkable thing is that you have much more variability in the coefficients associated with flows which are symmetric about the equator, these are the red ones, than you do in the ones which are anti-symmetric, the blue ones. And the it's now 20 years ago, I suppose, the group in Paris associated these variable axisymmetric flows with torsional oscillations going all the way back to Brzezinski's theory. So flows which are seen at the top of the core, which are symmetric about the equator, and on one of these cylinders, everything is moving at the same rate. And I've just said here that there might be viscous and magnetic friction at the ends of these cylinders where the core interacts with the mantle, either viscously or through having some kind of electrical conductivity distribution here at the boundary, and then you have to drag the magnetic field lines through that electrical conductivity distribution. So we're going to come back to that because that's going to be something of interest. So let's continue with this very old story. So if one associates the let's go back. If one associates these flows, the time variability of these flows with torsional oscillations, that means by measuring the flow at the top of the core, one can get the flow everywhere on a cylinder. Therefore, that one can calculate what the angular momentum carried by such a flow would be, and the angular momentum must be conserved between the core and the mantle. So therefore, if I can calculate what the angular momentum carried in these flows in the core is, I can therefore predict the angular momentum of the solid Earth, and I can predict its rotation rate, therefore I can predict the length of the day. And this story, which started, as I say, about 20 years ago, has been, I think, very successful. So on this plot, this is taken out of Richard Ohm's treatise article. On this plot, we've got in the open squares, we've got the data which I showed you before, the length of day data measured astronomically. And then we've got four different models from different authors. Three of them are in red with different types of lines, and the original study from Jolt et al. Are these black dots. And I think you will agree that there is a remarkable similarity. Considering what's gone into this, considering where we've got these predictions from. These predictions are entirely geomagnetic in origin, but tied together with some very sensible theory. And these are the geodetic observations. So I think it's absolutely has to be the case that we do see the the signature of torsional oscillations in the geomagnetic data. Okay, so that's all very good. I want to come back to the question whether or not these are free or forced oscillations. So in other words, am I seeing torsional oscillations which are the result of one big bang which sends the system into free oscillations, or am I seeing the result of constant forcing of these oscillations? And that's what I want to get onto, because there's a paper that's just come out this year which I think is very interesting. So, a second source of information on the interaction between the core and the mantle are the nutations of the Earth. So we know that there are forcings, planetary forcings of the Earth at particular forcing periods, and you can measure the orientation of the Earth in space very accurately using very long baseline interferometry. And these are typical data that you see. So we have two angles, psi and epsilon here. And the reason there are three data series, these are all measurements of the same thing. They've simply been offset by with respect to one another. They come from different agencies, Goddard, the US Navy, and the International Astronomical Association, I guess. These are all measurements of the same thing. They're just showing the nutations of the Earth in space. Okay, very good. Now, this is an example where we know what the forcing is, and we can measure the response. So we can learn something about the Earth. And there is a very well-developed theory for the response of the Earth, if you have a model of the Earth. And you can look at how well that theory agrees at the different forcing periods. So here are the periods, 18.6 year retrograde, 1 year retrograde, half a year retrograde, half a year prograde, 1 year prograde, 18.6 year prograde. I guess this one in particular, the 18.6 year, is associated with the movement of the moon outside the plane of the ecliptic. And the thing that you will see here is that you basically, these are the residuals, observations minus theory. So it's telling you how well the theory works. And these residuals are pretty good. So the theory works quite well for the in-phase amplitude. But the out-of-phase amplitude, particularly here at the 18.6 years and at the 1 year at retrograde, is rather poor. And the fact that you have a large residual in the out-of-phase amplitude tells you that you must have some source of dissipation in the Earth, which is meaning that there is a lag between the response of the Earth to the driving. And the preferred explanation for this is in terms of coupling between the core and the mantle, and also between the inner core and the outer core. Magnetically. So these are the residuals when you have no coupling, and if you introduce coupling at the core-mantle boundary or at both the core and the inner core, you can reduce these residuals to really quite remarkable levels. And perhaps I should just tell you what this requires is that you have a conductance, let's say C, which is the integral of the electrical conductivity with respect to Z over some layer, which is 10 to the 8 Siemens, and it requires that you have an average of the radial field squared, averaged over the core-mantle boundary, and then I guess divided by the area and the square root. So the RMS radial field is going to be about 0.6 millitesla, which is The RMS is about twice the radial field that we observe in the first 1 to 14 degrees. Okay, so that's what these, that's what the nutation people would like as their favorite model to explain the observations, and it's very, very successful at explaining the observations. Now let's come back to the torsional oscillations, and this is the work that Matthew Dumbrie and Don Mound just published this year, which I think is quite interesting because they look at the ramifications of this particular explanation for the nutations. They look at what the ramifications are for the torsional oscillations. So if you have this conductivity structure at the top of the core and you have this amount of magnetic energy at the top of the core, you can calculate how much the torsional oscillations are damped. So what we've got plotted here is the period of the torsional oscillations. So that for a given magnetic field structure in the core, the torsional oscillations are the normal modes of the core, so there are a discrete number of, or there's an infinite number of normal modes, each with a particular frequency. So here the stars, for example, are the normal modes for a core model, which has got the amount of conductivity and the amount of energy at the core mantle boundary required by the nutations. So these are the periods of the normal modes here, and these are the decay times of those normal modes, and the decay times are governed by that friction, the magnetic friction at the tops of the cylinders. This line here is the line where the decay time is equal to the period of the torsion oscillations. So if in the parlance of mechanical systems, these oscillations here are underdamped. These on this line would be critically damped, and these here would be overdamped. So in this region, you're able to have many, many oscillations before the oscillation dies out. Down here, your oscillation really loses the sense of being an oscillation because it's so damped that really within one period it loses its amplitude so rapidly that you don't really have much of an oscillation. Now, the key thing is that these stars are for the for the model which requires this amount of conductance at the top of the core and this amount of magnetic energy. So the key thing is that if you accept the results from the nutations, it so happens that the torsional oscillations would be very, very overdamped. You would not see, so if you hit the system, it's not just going to go into many, many periods of free oscillation, it's just going to possibly do one very, very highly damped oscillation before dying out. So plotted on here are lots of other different models which would be the case if you don't have this amount of coupling at the core surface. So we're into, so the conclusion from this then is that thinking about the observations I showed you of the torsional oscillations, you would conclude that you are not seeing their free oscillations which result from one instantaneous perturbation to the system. You are really seeing the response of the system to a constant forcing. In other words, you're seeing much more to do with the source than you are to do with the response. Now, I just thought I would I'd mention some ways out of this. I don't have a strong opinion on any of this, but there's another way of explaining the nutation data, which is rather than having magnetic friction, is to actually have conventional viscous friction at the tops of the cylinders. And you only need to increase the viscosity of the core by a factor of 10 to the 4, and you can then explain the nutation data. So that would put the viscosity of the core up to 10 to minus 2 meters squared per second, or if you want, it's going to raise the Ekman number to 10 to minus 11. Maybe that's a suitable way out. I don't know. I mean, if one
that
starts
just
to
just at the top of the core, right? I mean, the Ekman number might be very much smaller throughout the bulk of the core, and you could still satisfy this condition.
Yeah.
Could you have a large viscosity just in a boundary layer at the top of the core?
Are you thinking of a turbulent viscosity,
or maybe like Dave was talking about, some stratification composition that would cause the viscosity?
Yeah. All that matters is there at the tops. Yeah. Yeah.
Could it be and the other question is, could it be the relevant turbulent viscosity?
I was just going to talk about that later.
Okay.
In this context.
Yeah.
Okay, good. So in fact, Philippe Cardan, this was something basically that Philippe Cardan said when he was contesting the interpretation of the nutations. He said, if you just raise the Ekman number to something like 10 to the 10, you can account for the damping. If we do that, then we would be seeing really free torsional oscillations, not forced. So it all hinges very critically on the interpretation of these of the nutations, really, and it's really rather difficult. Perhaps I should mention there's one difficulty with the nutation interpretation, which is that it actually requires very large magnetic fields at the inner core boundary, or seemingly large, it depends what you're comfortable with, but something like 7 millitesla at the core mantle boundary, at the inner core boundary, sorry. So I think it's quite interesting just putting together the nutation work with the torsional oscillation work. I just for fun I found this diagram which shows the different estimates of the outer core viscosity, which of course span about 15 orders of magnitude. even the theory varies quite over quite a large range. There's some experiments done by Rutter and Secco on iron sulfur about 5 years ago, which funnily enough come up in agreement with basically the GANS value of 10 to the minus 6 meters squared per second. But much of these theoretical values all come from assuming everything obeys Andrade's law of melting on that the viscosity remains constant on the melting curve.
There's a first principles estimate
that Kevin Owen and the first day they get the GANS.
Yeah.
Did you get viscosity from sex bond?
Oh, I think it's from. Is it not from damping of normal modes or damping of? I don't know where this comes from.
There are estimates, but I think they're all basically 1/0 the noise. They're actually a measure of the error in estimating Q away from the core, and the estimates go down as the period of the waves goes up. And I think the lowest value was the Chandler one.
I don't know, but that would probably come under geodesy, wouldn't it? Not seismology.
Okay.
That's all.
Any questions on that, Ben?
Do these torsional oscillations, do they have sort of specific variation in radius? They do.
They've got
these cylinders are going according to some function of S.
Well, if you break it down in frequency, you've got a specific normal mode, which has got its amplitude can be, for example, its amplitude can be enhanced in regions. Depends on BS, basically. It depends on the cylindrical average of BS.
I mean, even if they are not over damped, I guess there's no reason to expect that there's a very impulsive excitation of these, but rather maybe it's like in helioseismology, excitation of all the modes is going on all the time in a turbulent system.
It doesn't really make much difference whether they're overdamped or not. Yeah.
Except you could have some resonance for some given periods if they were actually less damped than others. We have preference for some periods, for example.
Yeah, but there's an infinite spectrum of modes.
Yeah, anyway. But for example, the ones with shorter periods were less damped.
You alluded to the fact that there's coupling at the CMB, electromagnetic coupling at the CMB, and also through the inner core boundary, the ICB, through gravitational coupling, yes. How good are the nutation measurements at separating those two? I mean, could you say, well, in fact, that sort of the inner core, well, the CMB coupling is almost nil and it's all through the inner core boundary,
It does actually seem a rather technical business, but they do. I mean, they've actually only got to estimate essentially two numbers, really, and they do seem to be able to. So, for example, if you just introduce CMB coupling, you can only reduce the residuals to here. If you introduce them both, you can really get. On the money.
What I'm suggesting, why don't you just use ICB coupling only?
It's not plotted, is it? I suspect you might be able to do a reasonable job. I don't know. It would be something to ask. I think Bruce is coming next week.
Isn't he?
Next week.
Is he?
Isn't inner core coupling going to influence some specific periods
for others, right? Because it would be influencing the impending cylinder. Mm-hmm. Well, you need to have some at the core mantle boundary because that's where the shearing is for some of these modes. Really. This free core rotation.
I mean, yes, I think you're right, Barbara. I was trying to think about that. I mean, the decay time, in other words, the thing that shows how much dissipation there is, it does vary, but very slightly, at least in this model, very slightly with the period of the normal mode. So the longest period normal modes are actually, they decay the slowest. So the short period ones decay fastest, but it's all very model dependent. Well, okay, I guess they're all kind of parallel. So yes, it depends on the mode, how quickly it, just like in normal mode size module, I guess it's the same thing.
Okay, well, thank you.
Okay, I just wanted to raise one simple question, and in fact Andy has already raised it much more efficiently, so I had five slides, I can skip four of them, so I go quickly to... No, but that's great, you are all hungry, so...
No
problem. I just wanted to tell that these nutation data are actually, I think, very important. I share some of Dave's views that observations are very important, but most often they don't give you the answer to your questions, but rather give you more questions, and that's, I think, the case with this nutation data. So I won't go back into this fact that the sun gravity torque has some effect on the Earth's rotation axis with precession and nutation around this precession circle. seen that already. And the one which is important for these results in particular is what's called the nearly diurnal oscillation of the core. And that's the one you get this strong constraint on the, so it's called the retrograde free core notation. And I'm not a specialist in that. So, but from these geodetic observations, you get basically this number, which is the ratio of the torque that you know, which applies on the mantle, and the inertial moment of the Earth, which you also know, and you get this from the geodetic measurements. This is basically the position, the rotation rate of the instantaneous rotation rate of the mantle. And the value which is gotten from this very precise VLBI measurements is something of that sort for the imaginary part, which is the out of phase one, which tells you that there must be some kind of dissipation going on at the core mantle boundary. And the theory is now fairly well worked out, taking into account all the things which can happen there. This is just a cartoon of the CMB, the mantle part, the core part. And you have to take into account several things which happen, which are basically due to the fact you have a shear discontinuity at the interface. So mantle moves and it imposes velocity discontinuity on the core. And that velocity discontinuity has both some magnetic and some viscous effects. The first thing which has been studied is just the viscous part only. The yellow model is a Greenspan and Loper theory. Basically, you have a boundary layer, you shear there, and you have accommodation of the shear in some Ekman boundary layer, and you get what's the torque for that very easily. Then Buffett in 1992 had this low field model. He considered only the magnetic coupling there, and you have this red curve, but with no influence on the velocity in the fluid part of the core. And then he realized that actually his model predicted very strong field at the core mantle boundary, and he had an extension of the model. Well, you take into account the Lorentz force, which actually changes the profile of velocity in the core. And finally, more recently, there was a combination of all the viscous and magnetic effects in kind of more global theory, which gives you the green type of model, in which you can have both magnetic coupling and some viscous coupling modified by the presence of the magnetic field. So the theory is fairly...
Both those green.
Yeah, now the theory, basically, they all agree on the derivation and on the numbers you get with that, in fact. And there is another one, in fact, Smiley and somebody else, I think. So that's, for the theory, that's well worked out for this magneto-viscous coupling. And the question is, what do you do with that? And already Andy explained to us that it was quite a strong constraint. You have the choice between these three different types of couplings. You can couple the couplings also. Magnetic coupling, and you really need to have then a lowermost mantle which has electric conductivity of the core, basically, so metallic type conductivity, and a magnetic field which is, as Andy already mentioned, 0.69 millitesla, and that's quite a lot. I mean, it's more than twice what's observed. Of course, we observe only the magnetic field at, up to degree and order 13, from because the rest is filtered out or not large enough amplitude to be above the crust signal at the top of the at the surface of the Earth. So that's pretty difficult. I mean, and there was a recent paper by Bruce Buffett and Uli where they show compare with some dynamo calculations. That's still above what you would expect from extrapolating dynamo computation. So it's still okay with heat dissipation in the core, but it's kind of really on the verge of what you can easily do. Another possibility is viscous coupling, but then you need a viscosity for the core, again, as Andy said, of about at least this number, 0.03 square meter per second, and from the rest, that is theory or Gans law and all these things, you expect well, something like that. Or finally, some kind of, well, I call it inertial coupling. I don't know if it's the best, but it's kind of turbulent viscosity effect. But then you need a stress, again, to match the observation of about 10 to minus 3 pascals. And most often through this inertial coupling, you can compare with what you get for the stress from the velocity fluctuations. And this is discussed again in the Bruce and Uli paper. If you take the velocity which is associated with this mode of nutation, these diurnal velocities, they are of the order of 10 to the minus 4 meter per second. And then you get with something which is of the order of 10 to the minus 4 Pascal when you'd like to have something like 10 to the minus 3. So I have no answer to that. It's just, I think it's an important issue, one of the few observations which directly bears to on the coupling between core and mantle and possible implications on viscosity or turbulent viscosity. And I just wanted to see if there were some any ideas of how we can get out, well, can get the camel through the eyes of the needle on that.
Is it so surprising that we wouldn't be using a turbulent viscosity? The turbulent viscosity is parallel to
well,
when
you compute the stability of the Ekman number of the Ekman layer for these velocities, they are stable in the core. I mean, but if you have something like topography, it's difficult to imagine that the Ekman layer will not be disturbed. It's only a few centimeters thick, right? Will not be disturbed by topography at the core mantle boundary. So you would expect probably some effect of that sort, but still you can't go farther than this type of value with turbulent viscosity, I think. So.
But do we know that the velocity, the turbulent velocity, is within a factor of 3? I mean, a factor of 3 larger would get you there.
Well, in there, what I've taken and what they have taken, Uli and Bruce, is the actual velocity of which corresponds to the motion of this nutation mode. That's the question I have. I'm not sure that's would be necessarily the only way to go, but it seems reasonable. But if you have an Ekman layer which is already quite thick because of some other things going on, wouldn't that still play a role on the coupling that you get for these type of velocities? That's for me not quite clear.
What some source of locking is discussed by David help? I mean, you can somehow lock the oscillation. Would that help some work?
Well, there we're talking about this nutation. So it's basically, as seen from the mantle part, it's basically you, every day you are having this little rotation motion. So you can't really lock this motion, I think. It's, yeah.
That's an interesting question, actually. If you put nu equals 1, what happens? Do you damp everything out?
Nu equals 1? This one here?
Nu equals 1 is incompatible. Because nu equals 1
yeah,
is right
that would
in the
be middle
of these estimates on this stuff.
Is it LDB?
I think nu equals 1 would yeah, I think nu equals 1 would be too much for this.
Most of these points on your slide were upper bounds.
Yeah, one estimate.
Well, this is a good point. This is a better upper bound than most of the ones that I've seen. It isn't upper bound. I mean,
of course, you can combine all three, but it doesn't help very much because they are all kind of one order of magnitude off, so adding them doesn't really help. Well, no, they are not one order of magnitude. If you accept this hypothesis, magnetic coupling works fine, but they are strong hypotheses.
Well, can you just remind us how much of a struggle is it to get this amount of power beyond degree 40 to get a dynamo to have 0.7 millitesla?
Well, what we did in this paper, compare it with a dynamo simulation that, of course, we know all the dynamo simulations, they fail in several parameters by many orders of magnitude. What we did here is at least to pick a magnetic Reynolds number that is presumably Earth-like. And presumably the magnetic Reynolds number is one. I mean, the problem is that, as you pointed out, in the observed magnetic field, which is only the long wavelengths part, you only get about half of the mean magnetic field strength and what you need. So in order to work, there must be the spectrum must be fairly wide out to fairly high degree, beyond regular harmonic degree 100 or something like that. And
And with dynamo simulations, we don't quite get there. We can get a fairly wide spectrum, but it's still, it's not completely wide. It is slightly reddish, and we don't quite get up to this 0.7 millitesla. If we renormalize it in a way that in degrees up to 13, we just have what we observe today for the Earth. However, I'm not sure what are all the factors determining the magnetic energy spectrum. Certainly magnetic Reynolds number will be an important factor, but obviously also the scales of the flow itself won't be right. The Ekman number is far too large. So perhaps we can get there. The other question was whether such kind of spectrum would violate constraints on the ohmic dissipation. It would just be too dissipative, but this doesn't seem to be the case. You can get this energy, you can get a fairly wide spectrum out to such a degree and not really violate any strong constraints on the total amount of
dissipation. But really the trend is in the right direction. As you increase, as it becomes more and more turbulent and the viscosities decrease, the spectrum becomes broader and broader. So maybe there is.
Yeah, perhaps there is a way to, if we could, if we take really realistic Ekman number into account.
Well, except that you might expect that it's mostly concerned by the magnetic Reynolds number when you have this.
We got right. Yeah. So, yeah. Certainly, at some point, you cannot simply continue because magnetic diffusion takes over so strongly.
Is this one of these things where it's the conductance that matters rather than the electrical conductivity? What happens if some of these ultra-low velocity zones are really sort of higher?
I think I had one of the slides I just too quickly look here. There are actually some. It depends on the conductivity. It's a kind of skin effect, basically. So it depends on the conductivity you have there. I think that with the nominal conductivity, which is the one of the core, you get something like 150 meters. That could be enough for making the coupling, if I'm not wrong.
Because you have patches, like the ultra-low-velocity ones.
You could. When people have tried to explain such a large value of the conductivity, basically, they come up with trapping something which looks more like the core material in the mantle side. But when people, I think there were some studies by Poirier and others, if you try to infiltrate core liquid iron in the mantle, it's a bit difficult to go even that high up. I mean, 150 meters is already quite high in terms of surface tension effects and so on. Don't help you going that high.
There's quite a bit of doubt. It's rather coming down to
1078. Yeah, and that's really, for me, it's still an open question. If we're ready to accept this hypothesis, it's fine, but there are really strong hypotheses.
I'm not sure this has anything to do with geodynamo, but if you look at standard Cartesian small scale dynamo simulations, either like low PM or large PM, they all peak more or less at the resistive scale. So, and like for the velocity spectrum, you get some form of a bell-like shape for magnetic energy spectrum, and it doesn't peak at the lowest wave numbers. Mm-hmm. So most of the energy is contained at smaller scales. So the question here is, what would be the resistive scale in that system in terms of spherical harmonics?
Chris and Paul have worked on that, I think, if I remember well. You had some.
Yes, we did this. I think it came out about 30, 40 kilometers, that kind of.
So it's very
small.
I had in mind something more like L equals 30, no? But that was after some.
L equals 30 or 40 is what Henri Claude says from L. Yeah, I think that's quite right. That's quite a long way up. So, I mean, all we see is down to L equals 13, isn't it? That's some.
But in that range, is the main energy spectrum decreasing?
Yes.
I must look it up, what our results were in this paper with Bruce, but I think what you really need to get up is quite a lot of energy beyond 100.
Yeah. Sorry, up to 300, 260, something, 60, something like that.
Okay, well, I think that's... thank you very much.